but that rarely happened. Bystanders, souvenir hunters, looters, grieving family members would pollute the scene with trace evidence, smear fingerprints, and walk off with everything from telltale epidermal cells to the murder weapon itself. And some of the worst offenders were the first responders. Understandably, of course, saving lives and clearing a scene of the bad guys take priority, but leads have been destroyed and suspects found not guilty because otherwise solid evidence was destroyed by tactical teams and EMTs. Here, though, once it looked like Verlaine had offed himself, the entry team backed out and let Lily and Amelia, armed with their Glocks, clear the place. They were careful not to disturb anything. Then Lily backed away and let the expert do her thing. Now in her crime scene unit overalls, booties, and hood, Amelia was walking carefully through the 50x50 open space. "It's like a junkyard rhyme." Workbenches were littered with tools and slabs of metal and stone and instruments, welding masks, gloves, and leather jackets so thick they seemed bulletproof. The floor was equally cluttered, rough-hewn wooden boxes holding ingots of metal, pallets loaded with stone and more scrap. Gas tanks filled one wall, hand trucks and jacks, electric saws and drill presses. Overhead, a series of rails and tracks ran throughout the space at ceiling height, about 15 feet up. These held electric pulleys and winches for transporting loads of metal and the finished sculptures throughout the space. Rusty chains and hooks dangled. How homey, Amelia thought. And everywhere, Verlaine sculptures, made of metal sheets and bars and rods, welded or soldered or bolted together. Bronze mostly, but some iron and steel and copper. It was as if he couldn't bear to have a space in his studio not presided over by one of his ladies. And ladies in extremis. Though the works were impressionistic, there was no doubt what each one depicted. A woman in pain, just as horrific as Lucas Davenport had described. Bent over backward, on all fours, tied down on their backs, crying in agony, pleading. Some were pierced by lengths of rebar reinforcing rods. She forced herself to look past the disturbing sculptures and get to work. Just because Verlaine apparently killed himself, Amelia didn't search any less carefully. After all, suicide is technically a homicide. That the perp and the vic are the same simply means the investigators don't have to hump as hard as in murder, but they still have to hump. And in this case, of course, there was a lot at stake, even after Verlaine's death. She was well aware that the sculptor might have kidnapped and stashed another victim somewhere else, chained underground, with only a few days to live before she died of thirst or bled out, if he'd been having some of his sick fun with her. Amelia searched the hell out of the scene. First, she processed the body, photographing and filming, then clearing and bagging the Glock he'd used, collecting the one spent 9mm shell, swabbing his hands for gunshot residue and wrapping them in plastic bags as well. She bagged his Dell laptop, along with the phone and iPad, noting that there'd been no hard copy or e-version suicide notes. She'd just run a case where a man's farewell before leaping off the 59th Street Bridge had been tweeted. Amelia searched the way she always did, walking the grid. This involved pacing step by step in a straight line from one end of the scene to the other, and then turning around, moving slightly to the side, and returning. And then, when she was done with that, she covered the same ground again, perpendicular to the first search. For an hour, she walked the grid, taking samples of trace. She collected the necklaces and crosses in the alcove. Seeing them up close, Amelia realized that several of them looked familiar, and finally she knew why. In the pictures Verlaine had shown to her and Lily in the bar, the women he was playing his S&M games with had all been wearing necklaces like these. Yes, Lucas was right. They were trophies. Trophies not of the murder victims, but of his sexual conquests. Then she turned to the steel door Lucas had told them about, the one leading to the basement. It had been unlocked when the team entered, and she and Lily had cleared it fast. Now she searched it from the point of view of a forensic cop. The small underground chamber was brick-lined and had a raw concrete floor. The smells were of heating oil, mold, standing water, and sweat. Maybe that last scent was her imagination, but she thought not. She looked at the hooks protruding from the walls, the stains on the floor. Amelia walked down a set of rickety stairs into the thoroughly creepy place. She ran a fast fluorescein test on several of the dark patches. The results confirmed her initial hypothesis of blood. And there was no doubt about the bits of dark, elastic curl she popped into evidence bags. She knew dried flesh when she saw it. Her gloved finger hit transmit, and a moment later she heard Lincoln's impatient voice.
Sachs, where the hell are you?
On the other side of the steel door in Verlaine's basement.
And?
It's almost a home run.
That's like being nearly pregnant,
but I'll forgive the sloppy metaphor just this once. Get the evidence back ASAP. He disconnected without a goodbye. Lucas was staying at the Four Seasons on 57th Street. He was lying in bed with his toenails scratching the top sheet, thinking about clipping his nails and then walking over to Madison Avenue to do a little shopping for an autumn ensemble, when his cell phone rang.
Amelia, get over here, right now.
What happened?
It's not good, and better not to talk about it on a cell phone.
He needed to clean up. Unless there was a shootout going on at Lincoln's townhouse, he figured he had that much time. He was out of the hotel 15 minutes after the call and found a taxi outside the front door, dropping off a customer. Lucas got in the cab and gave the driver Lincoln's address, and the driver said,
"Not hardly worth turning on the meter for that.
Do what you want. I'll give you a 20 when we get there." The driver drove with some enthusiasm, and Lucas was ringing Lincoln's doorbell 20 minutes after Amelia called.
"What happened?" he asked when she opened the door.
"Lily's been detained by internal affairs. They could be coming for us next."
"What?"
"I'll let Lincoln tell you." Lincoln smiled when Lucas came in and said,
"Now things are getting interesting.
Tell me." The evidence that Amelia had collected under Lincoln's direction, which Lincoln conceded was quite good under typical circumstances, had not been taken to Lincoln's lab, but to the city laboratory. First, they found some evidence that the dead women had been tortured and murdered in a small storage area in the basement of the sculptor's studio. Not much evidence was visible, but the small stuff, tiny spatters of blood, flakes of skin, urine samples, proved that the dead women had been there. The gun had also been examined, and that was where the problem arose.
"Last year, we had another psycho roaming around the city, but he was not particularly clever. He was a serial shooter, a guy named Levon Pitt, owned a junkyard here in town. That's where he had dumped the bodies. Lily ran the team that tracked him down. They had an entry team and cracked his apartment, but there was nobody home. So they set up outside the apartment to wait for him, and pretty soon, here he came with his adult son. When the police approached him, he figured out what was about to happen and pulled a gun and actually tried to take his son hostage. In the scuffle, he fired the gun once, and Lily shot him, firing three times, and he died on the way to the hospital. When the man had been shot, Lily froze the scene, and they brought in the crime scene crew. Among other things, they recovered seven different pistols in the man's apartment. He'd used four different weapons in the murders that the police knew about, and after testing, they found that three of the guns they'd recovered were among the four used in the crime."
Lincoln paused in his narration, and Lucas prompted,
"So?
The gun we found yesterday, by Verlaine's hand, was the fourth gun."
"What?"
Lucas was momentarily confused. "Verlaine was involved with Levon Pitt?"
"That's not what they're suggesting," Lincoln said. "For one thing, there's no apparent connection. For another, one of the shells in Verlaine's gun had Lily's fingerprint on it."
It took Lucas a moment to get it.
"So they're saying what, that she picked up a gun at the first sight and kept it as a throwdown? And then she went into Verlaine's apartment sometime last night, killed him, and made it look like a suicide?"
"That's what they're suggesting."
"That's ridiculous," Lucas said.
"Internal affairs doesn't think so," Amelia said. "The thing is, they can't figure out any other mechanism for getting Lily's fingerprint on that shell. She never touched the gun at Verlaine's place."
"But why would she do that? Why kill Verlaine?
After I went in there, we knew we had him."
But we had no hard evidence, and that's all Internal Affairs knows. That's what Lily reported last night. We can't tell them that we did have hard evidence because then we'd have to tell them that you illegally entered. So their theory is she knew who the killer was but couldn't get at him, so she killed him, got him off the street.
Oh, man, that's not right, Lucas said.
There's another aspect to it, Amelia said. Lily is an operator. She gets things done, but she steps on a lot of toes. That's fine when she's got all that protection at the top, but now, with this, well, somebody leaked the lab results almost instantly. Probably some old bureaucratic enemy. It's on every TV station in New York. They're screaming for her head.
Don't forget to tell them about what else is coming down the line, Lincoln said.
Oh, yeah. Amelia pulled out her cell phone and looked at the time. IA wonders if any of us had anything to do with it. We've got a couple of homicide cops on the way here. They want to talk to us. I know them. They're hard-nosed guys.
Lucas shrugged. We leave out the burglary, leave out the evidence collection from last night, and tell them everything else. And we tell them that they're being taken as chumps, that Lily couldn't have done this, and that somebody is running a con on them.
That'll piss them off, Amelia said.
Which is what we want to do, Lucas said. We want them on the defensive. We want them off our back so we can figure out what actually happened, and we tell them that.
The question, Lucas Davenport spat out, is who's setting her up?
Lincoln agreed. That was the only question.
There was no doubt in the minds of Lucas, Amelia, and Lincoln that Lily was innocent. However much of a shit Jim Bob Verlaine had been, however guilty he was of sadistic murder, and however much of a tough number Lily Rothenberg was, there was no way she'd take him out like that. The team was back at Lincoln's townhouse, all of them except Lily, of course, who was still being detained, and whose absence was glaringly obvious.
So, Lucas repeated, who's behind it?
Somebody with a grudge? Amelia offered.
Could be, Lucas said. She's made some enemies in her day, or maybe some asshole wants to derail a case she's running.
And what about Verlaine? Amelia asked. Did he kill those women, or was he being set up too? And what's the reason behind that?
Lincoln's view, admittedly myopic at times, as to the questions why and who, was generally best answered by how and what. That is, by the evidence.
Why waste fucking time speculating? Look at the facts.
You ever in a good mood, Lincoln? Lucas asked. A grunt suggested that the answer might be no. But Lucas took his point.
What do we have to prove the suicide was faked?
Looking over Amelia's photos of the body, Mel Cooper said,
powder burns and muzzle stamp are consistent with a close contact gunshot.
Lucas regarded the pictures too. And the tissue, blood, and bone on the receiver of the piece confirm that. But it was a temple shot. That's rare in self-inflicted wounds. Usually the poor bastard bites the muzzle. Which means somebody could have pulled out the piece when Verlaine was turned away, come up behind or beside him, and shot. So maybe he knew the shooter.
Cooper said, but there was gunshot residue on Verlaine's hands.
Firing any pistol, and most rifles, results in burnt gunpowder particles and gases contaminating the hand holding the weapon. But Lucas muttered,
fuck, that's easy.
He fired twice.
Yes, Lincoln said enthusiastically. Good. Verlaine lets the perp in. He or she stands beside him and blows his brains out. Then the perp puts the gun in Verlaine's hand and pulls the trigger again. Bang! Verlaine's fingerprints are on the piece and GSR's on his hand. Perp collects the second shell and leaves the gun on the floor.
But where's the other slug? Cooper asked.
Lucas, clearly pissed his friend had been set up, snapped, Christ, just look at the pictures of the scene. The whole goddamn studio's like a gun range bullet trap, 1,000 hunks of metal. Half of his, quote, art looks like a monkey pounded on it with a hammer. Nobody'd spot a bullet ding.
Amelia said, okay, that could work, but the big issue, what about Lily's fingerprint on the shell casing fired from the murder weapon? How the hell did the perp finesse that?
She tossed her long red hair over a shoulder. Lincoln was amused to see Lucas following the sweep closely. He reflected, just because you're a faithful husband doesn't mean you're blind.
Lincoln said, Internal Affairs is claiming that Lily picked the gun up at the scene where she shot Levon Pitt, rescuing his son. What was the name again?
The boy? Mel Cooper asked, flipping through a file.
Andy. Lucas then snapped his fingers. Hold on. Something's wrong here. It's Levon Pitt's gun, and presumably it was loaded with Pitt's ammo. Why would Lily reload the mag with her rounds? That makes no sense. I'm not saying she'd take somebody out like that, but if she did, she wouldn't be stupid about it. Amelia said, somebody stole one of her cartridges and popped it in the mag.
Wore gloves.
Or knuckled it, Lucas said, referring to loading a weapon by holding the bullets between your fingers, never letting the tips come in contact with the brass or slug. Lucas nodded. Our friend Markowitz ain't real crazy about the boys and girls from narcotics being involved, but it's leaning that way to me.
Well, IA's not going to take our word for it, Cooper pointed out. How do we prove somebody copped a spent shell from Lily?
An idea occurred to Lincoln.
Call ballistics. Have them test fire a round from the bottom of the mag of the gun at Verlaine's suicide. I want 3D images of that shell compared with the one with Lily's prints on it, and I fucking want them now.
Will do.
Not that fast, but it wasn't bad. A half hour later, the images were on the big monitor in front of them.
Lincoln glanced toward Lucas, then Amelia.
You two are the shoot-'em-up mavens. What do you think?
It took no more than a fast glance. They nodded at each other. Lucas said, The shell with Lily's prints was machined to fit the receiver of Pitt's gun. The real perp got one of her cartridges and altered it.
Yep, Amelia agreed.
So whoever did it knows weapons and metalwork. It's real high quality, close tolerances.
Okay, that proves she was set up, but it doesn't get us any closer to who's setting Lily up, Cooper said.
Breaking a lengthy silence, Lucas said, Maybe it does.
Amelia, you know somebody in the NYPD evidence room?
Know somebody? She asked, laughing.
It's my home away from home.
Stan Markowitz stood at the podium beside the police commissioner, along with some minion from the mayor's office and a public affairs officer or two. They were in the press room in One Police Plaza. Microphones and cameras and cell phones and video mode bristled like RPGs and machine guns, aimed the officials' way, though Markowitz, it seemed, was the preferred prey in the crosshairs, to judge from the tight shots.
I don't think your boss is having a good day, Lincoln said to Amelia.
They sat beside each other, watching on the big screen TV in the corner of his parlor. Lucas was elsewhere, preparing.
Doesn't look it. And what do you think? She mused. Half the city's watching?
Half the country, Lincoln countered. No good serial killers in the news lately. All the sharks want a piece of this one.
Every media outlet except C-SPAN and Telemundo, it seemed, was represented.
Ladies and gentlemen, Markowitz began reasonably, though with a tone that suggested he actually viewed them as sharks.
He was drowned out by their shouted questions.
What was the motive for the torture? Is it significant that the victims were minorities? Is there a connection between this case and the Becker case a few years ago involving Lucas Davenport? Could you fill us in about Verlaine's sex life?
Frenzy.
Markowitz had obviously done this before, and he began speaking very softly. An old trick. Suddenly, the sharks realized that they weren't going to hear anything if they kept yammering away, and they spontaneously, to a fish, fell silent. The COD gave it a beat and then continued. As you are probably aware, a thorough examination and analysis of evidence and behavioral profiling led investigators to believe that a resident of Manhattan, James Robert Verlaine, was the perpetrator in the spate of recent killings of women in the city. Mr. Verlaine appeared to take his own life as a result of said investigation, and evidence supported that supposition.
Lincoln muttered,
Ah, so pleased to see that they still teach courses at the academy in using 10 words when one will do.
Amelia laughed and kissed his neck.
You are probably also aware that it was believed that an NYPD detective shot and killed Mr. Verlaine, and attempted to cover up the murder by making it appear that the death was a suicide.
Further investigation has determined that the detective, Lily Rothenberg, was not, in fact, involved in the death of Mr. Verlaine. A person or persons intentionally planted evidence in an attempt to implicate the detective. This officer has been exonerated. It now appears, too, that Mr. Verlaine was not the perpetrator behind the murder of the women. Detective Rothenberg is once again in charge of the task force investigating the killings. We expect to have a suspect in custody soon. I have no further comments at this time. Does that mean, Chief of Detectives, that Verlaine was murdered by this suspect as well?
A new microphone logo popped into sight. Telemundo had arrived.
Can you tell us what leads Detective Rothenberg is working on? Can you reassure the people of New York that no one else is at risk?
Markowitz studied the sharks for a moment, and Lincoln thought he was actually going to say, "How fucking stupid do you have to be not to understand? I have no further comments."
Instead, "Thank you."
He turned and walked off the stage. Amelia made a few calls to the television stations, posing as an angry cop, and told them that Lily was at Lincoln's townhouse.
"She's guilty. She's the one who did it. You got to get on her," she told the newsies.
Within the hour, there were 6 news crews and 50 rubberneckers on the sidewalk outside of Lincoln's townhouse. One of them finally came up and pounded on the door, and Amelia peeked out and asked what they wanted.
They wanted Lily.
After some back and forth, Lily went out on the stoop, told them that she would make one statement for the record, and that would be it.
"I have some very clear ideas of how this may have happened," she began. "Are you guilty?" somebody shouted.
"Of course I'm not guilty," Lily said. "I'm not guilty of anything except trying to track down a torture killer. But the possibilities now are quite few, the logical possibilities. I'll knock them down one at a time, and when I'm finished, we'll have this madman within the next day or two. I'm confident of that." The press conference lasted for another 2 or 3 minutes. Then she said she would not talk any more about it and went back inside. The news crews dispersed, with the exception of a radio reporter. The rubberneckers went with them. An hour later, Lucas stuck his head out the door.
"If you're waiting for Lily, she went out the back a half hour ago."
At 10 o'clock that night, Lucas and Lily headed over to the west side, in the 30s west of 9th Avenue. They were tracked by 2 other cars, each with 2 cops in them, including Amelia. Lily took a call and then said to Lucas, "He's on the way. He'll get off at Penn Station and then walk over, unless he's going somewhere else."
"I'm worried," Lucas said. "He's nuts. If he goes off on you, I mean, he could just..."
"He works at a hospital. He's unlikely to be carrying a gun, and the stuff I'm wearing is stab-resistant."
"Nothing is stab-proof, though," Lucas said. "What we really need to do is slow down."
"I disagree," Lily said. "This is hot right now. He's got to be feeling the street. If he has too much time to think about it, he can start covering it up. If he really thinks about it, he'd know that I'd never approach him alone. We can't let him think." Andy Pitt lived in a dark brownstone building that would take at least 50 yuppies and a couple of generations to gentrify, Lucas thought. They sat a block away, and the few people on the sidewalks either crossed the street or moved to the far edge of the sidewalk when they realized that there were people in the parked cars. A couple went by, and then a too-happy guy with a white dog. Lily took a call on a police handset.
"He's on the sidewalk. He's coming this way."
"Wire is good," Lucas said. Lily was wearing a wire over her vest, which made her look a little paunchy, but paunchy was okay, considering the alternative. They took a call from Amelia, who was with 3 other cops, concealed down some cellar steps at a building on the other side of the street.
"We're set here."
A minute later, she took another call.
"He's crossed 9th, still coming on. He's got a grocery sack."
Another 2 minutes.
"He's 2 blocks out."
Lily said,
"Let's go."
Lily went to the stoop that led into the apartment building. The doors were locked, but the rake opened them in a moment, and Lucas stepped into the entry hall. There was a weak, bare bulb light inside, and he reached up and unscrewed it, a 1/4 inch at a time because of the heat. When it went out, he unscrewed it another 1/4 inch, then pulled his gun, cocked it,
and leaned against the wall. Lily was facing him through the glass, 5 inches away, and he could hear her radio. "He'll turn the corner in 10 seconds. 9, 8. Lily opened the door, turned off the radio, and handed it to Lucas. They were both counting. 7, 6, 5, 4. Andy turned the corner. Lucas was looking past Lily's head, and he said, just loud enough for her to hear, "He's seen you. Bang on the door." She banged on the door. Lucas said, "He's coming up. He's 100 feet out." Lily turned away from the door as if giving up, then saw Andy in his bag. Andy stopped under the only nearby streetlight, and Lily walked down the steps and called, "Police! Is that you, Andy? Wait there!" If he ran, they'd have to try something different. He didn't run. He said, "You're the cop who killed my father." "That's right. I have a few questions for you. We're trying to find out how a piece of brass, a shell from a 9mm cartridge, got into a gun that was used in another killing. You may have heard about it. After I thought about it, Andy, there's only one way, isn't there? You picked it up. We froze the crime scene, but you were right in the middle of it with your father. What did you do, step on it, kneel on it? You were kneeling right next to him." Lucas, watching him from the window, saw Andy do something with his left hand, his free hand, something in the pocket of his jacket. Couldn't see what, but Lily didn't seem worried, but then she might not have been able to see the move. She pushed him, still talking. "Found the kill room and found some DNA that shouldn't have been there. Not much, a few flakes of skin, but good enough for us. So, I have a warrant. We need a DNA sample from you. It won't hurt. I have a kit. We need you to scrub a swab against your gums." "I knelt on it," Andy said.
"What?"
"I knelt on it. The shell. I didn't try to do that. I just knelt on it by accident. When I saw what it was, I put it in my pocket."
"And you reloaded it?"
"Of course. My pop and I reloaded everything. When you shoot a lot, you don't want to waste all that brass. We saved more than half, except that we shot more."
"Who killed the women? You or Verlaine?"
"Not Verlaine." Andy laughed and dropped his grocery sack by his ankle. "We had the same interests, but he never had the guts to do anything real. He just liked to get the women in there and pose them like slave girls and make his sculptures, and then he'd go around to the S&M clubs and brag about it. But he had that room down in the basement where he kept his finished work. He had that big steel door because the metal thieves will take that bronze shit and melt it right down, but that was perfect. I'd get the girls down there and I'd do what I wanted, what he dreamed about. You ever had a slave? There's nothing like it."
"Why'd you kill him?"
"Because of you. I didn't even know how close you were to finding him, even with all those clues I left for you, all those brass filings. But I had that shell, and a shell is a terrible thing to waste. You killed my pop. I thought they'd put you in prison so you'd have all that time to think about it."
"Why those victims, Andy? Why those particular women?"
But he didn't answer, just stepped closer, fist coming out of his pocket. Lucas stepped through the door with his gun and shouted, "He's got something in his hand! Lily, he's got something!" Lily jumped back, but Andy was right with her, grabbed her by the collar and yanked her back, looking around. "Stay away! Stay away!" he screamed. "I got a scalpel. I'll cut her face off." Amelia and the other cops emerged from the stairway across the street and spread out. "Get away. Get away or I'll cut her throat. I swear to God, I'll cut her fucking throat." He yanked Lily backward and Lily called to Lucas, "I can't reach my gun. It got stuck under the damn vest when he pulled me back." "Lucas, can you go down?"
"Maybe."
"Don't try anything. I just want to go away. I walk her up the block and I..." Lily, using both hands, grabbed his knife arm and pushed it away from her just an inch, and at the same time kicked her feet out from under herself and dropped. Amelia and Lucas fired at the same time, and Andy's head exploded. Lily landed on her ass and rolled away from the falling body. The scalpel tinkled to the ground 6 feet away. "That was not optimal," she said as she got back to her feet and turned to look down at the body. After that, it was mostly routine. Checking the tape, calling crime scene. Andy Pitt had 2 bullet holes in his head, one right through the forehead out the back,
and the second in one temple and out the other. As the scene was taped off, Lucas stepped over to Amelia and asked, "You okay?"
"I'm okay. How about you?"
"I'm okay," he said. He looked her over and said, "Do you know that you smile when you pull the trigger?"
They sat in government-issue furniture and wheelchair across from the chief of detectives, his office. Lucas, Lily, Amelia, and Lincoln. They were here for what Lincoln joked was the post-postmortem. Maybe in bad taste, but nobody was all that upset that Andy Pitt was lying in the morgue at the moment. Markowitz was on a call, nodding subconsciously, from which Lincoln deduced he was speaking, well, most likely listening, to his boss, the commissioner. Lincoln looked around. He thought the office was pretty nice, big, ordered, with nice views, though Lincoln had no use for views. His townhouse, for instance, offered a nice scene of Central Park. He invariably ordered Tom to close the curtains. Distracting. Markowitz hung up. His gaze incorporated them all. "Everybody upstairs is happy. I was worried. They were worried. Well, it was a little radical what you wanted to do, but it worked out." Lincoln shrugged, one of the few gestures he was capable of, and turned his chair slightly to face Markowitz. "The plan was logical. The execution competent," he said. Those were about his highest forms of praise. It was Lucas who'd initially come up with the theory of who'd killed Verlaine and set Lily up. "Amelia, you know somebody in the NYPD evidence room?" He had a possible source for the shell casing with Lily's fingerprint on it, the crime scene where she'd tapped Levon Pitt. Sure enough, the evidence log from that crime reported 3 slugs recovered, but only 2 spent casings. Somebody, possibly, had pocketed the 3rd. Okay, the gun at Verlaine's belonged to Levon Pitt. The shell casing at Verlaine's had been Lily's, fired when Pitt was shot, Lucas had pointed out when they'd learned this. How could they be linked? Only through the one individual who had a connection to them both, Andy Pitt, Levon's son, the kid who had, supposedly, been held hostage by his father. But what, Lucas speculated, if he hadn't been a hostage? What if he was his father's accomplice in the serial shootings back then, and he was enraged that Lily had killed his father? It made sense, Lincoln had agreed, and he'd pointed out that Andy might have met Verlaine through his father's junkyard, where, possibly, the sculptor bought metal for his art. They'd found where the young man lived and worked and set up surveillance. But no evidence implicated him. They needed more. They had to flush him, force him into making a move. And Lincoln had come up with a plan, using Lily as bait. They'd proved to Markowitz she was innocent and asked him to make the initial press announcement to that effect. Then Amelia contacted more reporters. Lily, too, had made her statement. That virtually guaranteed that Andy knew Lily was getting close. He'd have to make his move. "I can't thank you enough," Markowitz said. "I mean, you, Lucas, coming all the way from Minneapolis, that was really above and beyond the call."
"Glad to help out."
"Better get back to it." Markowitz's attention was elsewhere now. He was glancing at the notepad on which he jotted notes during his conversation with the commissioner. There were a lot of notes. But nobody rose. Lincoln glanced at Lily, who was the senior law officer here. She said, "Stan, just one thing we were thinking about, one loose end, sort of." Still distracted. "Loose end?" He was ticking off something on the paper in front of him. "You know what occurred to us? Remember we had the idea that somebody was using Verlaine to kill those women? Well, what if it wasn't Verlaine they were using, but Andy Pitt?" "Huh? I don't get it." Lily continued. "Sure, he had a motive to get even with me, but that doesn't mean somebody else didn't force him or hire him to kill those women and Verlaine." Amelia said, "Like, maybe somebody from Narcotics 4, after all. Andy Pitt never got to tell us why he picked those women. Why? Maybe the women could provide good info on drug operations in the city. Maybe it was Andy who got recruited by somebody in Narc 4.
"And another thing that we were pondering," Lincoln said,
"who exactly was it doing everything he could to protect the unit? The one who insisted that the killings had to be the work of a psycho,
Nothing to do with any cops.
Lily took over again.
That'd be you, Stan.
If the words didn't have Markowitz's full attention, the Glock that Lily drew and pointed more or less in his direction sealed the deal. The chief of detectives sighed.
God damn it.
What's the story, Stan? Amelia asked, voice cold. She tossed her hair. Lucas was still looking. There was a pause.
All right, Markowitz muttered. I did pull some strings to get the drug side of the investigation downplayed.
Let me guess, Lily snapped. Because the women were tortured and killed to get information on the drug player in town so Narc 4 could become the shining star of the department.
Guess again, detective. Markowitz gave a guttural laugh. You think there might have been some other reason why Narc 4 has such a great conviction record? Other than hiring a psycho to torture and kill users?
No one replied.
How about because the fucking head of Narc 4 was on the take?
Marty Glover?
Yeah, exactly. We've suspected it for 6 months.
Sure, the team was collaring suppliers and importers and meth cookers all over the city, except for one location, a big heroin distribution operation based in Red Hook, Brooklyn. He tapped a file on his desk. Glover was on their payroll and using Narc 4 to take down their competition. The others on the team weren't in on it. All they knew was that Glover had good sources.
Markowitz waved at Lily's weapon as if it were an irritating wasp. Do you mind?
She holstered the Glock, but kept her hand near the grip. The COD continued. But the Internal Affairs Red Hook operation against Glover had nothing to do with Verlaine or Pitt, or the torture murders. It was just a coincidence that women were druggies, the victims. But then you started looking for connections. Glover freaked out. I thought he was going to rabbit, go underground, and burn the evidence, so I told you to back off. That's all there was to it.
Lucas asked, what happened with Glover?
I didn't want to move so fast, but there was no choice. I called Candy Preston from Narc 4, and we set up a sting to nail Glover. I had her use one of her snitches to offer him a payoff, $50,000. I didn't think he'd go for it, but he couldn't resist. We got him on camera taking the bribe. It's not as righteous a collar as we'd like. I wanted some of the Red Hook scum, too, but the prosecutor will work him over. He'll give up names if we play with the sentencing.
Lincoln gave him points for credibility, but he remained skeptical. Lucas, too, apparently. He said, good story, Stan, but I think we'd all like confirmation. Who can we talk to who'll vouch for you?
Well, there's somebody who's been in the loop from the beginning of the Red Hook op.
Who?
The mayor.
Lincoln glanced toward Lucas and said,
works for me.
Outside, they headed toward the accessible van, where Tom sat in the driver's seat. He saw the entourage and hit the button that opened the door and lowered the ramp. Then he climbed out. Lincoln wheeled up to the van, then braked to a stop, spun around.
Anyone care to come back to the townhouse for an aperitivo? It's approaching cocktail hour.
Bit early, the aide pointed out.
Such a mother hen.
Tom, our guests have had an extremely traumatic time. Kidnapping was involved, knives were involved, gunplay was involved. If anybody deserves a bit of refreshment, it's them.
Love to, Lucas offered, but I'm heading back to the family. Got a flight in an hour.
I'm going to make sure he gets to the airport, Lily said, without getting into any trouble. They shook hands. Lincoln wheeled onto the ramp, and his aide fixed the chair to it with canvas straps. The criminalist said,
we should think about doing this again, Davenport.
Tom lifted his eyebrow.
Last name means he likes you, and he doesn't like many people.
Lincoln grumbled.
I'm not saying I like anyone. Where did that subtext come from? I'm simply saying this case didn't turn out to be the disaster it might have.
I may not be back here soon, Lucas said and cocked his head. But you ever get to Minnesota?
I used to go quite a bit.
You've been? Amelia asked.
Of course. I grew up in the Midwest, remember? Lincoln said impatiently. I'd go fishing for muskie and pike and Swan Lake and Minnetonka.
You fished? Tom asked. He seemed astonished.
And I've been to Hibbing.
a Bob Dylan pilgrimage.
Site of the largest open-pit iron mine in the world, Lucas said.
Lincoln nodded.
My first impression was that it'd be a great place to dispose of bodies. Had the same thought myself.
Then it's settled, Rhyme muttered.
You catch any good cases up there, something interesting, something challenging, give me a call.
Lily's been there, too, helping us out. We could get the team back together.
Lucas glanced at Amelia.
We'll go out to the range, you and me. I can teach you how to shoot.
And we can hit that highway you were mentioning. I'll give you a few tips on how to drive that toy car of yours.
Let's go, Sax, Lincoln called. We've got a crime scene report to write up.
Heather Graham versus F. Paul Wilson. Repairman Jack is one of fiction's most unique characters. F. Paul Wilson created him in 1984 as The Tomb, an urban mercenary who hires himself out to fix problems the system can't or won't deal with. The Tomb became a huge success. Despite that, though, Paul did not write the second Repairman Jack novel until 14 years later. Why? He says he was afraid Jack would take over his writing career. Finally, in 1998, Jack returned for what Paul said at the time was just one novel. But then he did another, and another. 22 novels later, it's safe to say that Repairman Jack definitely took over Paul's writing career. But that's okay. Both writer and character came to deeply know each other. Heather Graham is a publishing dynamo with over 100 novels to her credit. Romantic suspense, historical romance, vampire fiction, time travel, occult, even Christmas holiday fare. You name it, she's written it. But Heather's at her best when she blends a bit of paranormal with real human evil. And while Heather has been best known in recent years for her crew of Hunter novels, her Cafferty and Quinn series has long been simmering in the back of her mind. Let the Dead Sleep, 2013, began the first adventure from Michael Quinn and Danny Cafferty, followed by Waking the Dead. Michael Quinn is a special kind of guy. College football hero, too popular for his own good. Eventually, an excessive lifestyle causes his death in a hospital emergency room. Brought back to life by a crew of doctors, Quinn becomes a new man, never sure of exactly what he brought back with him from the dead. After meeting up with Danny Cafferty, who's just inherited her father's unique curio shop, Quinn finds that Danny will need everything he can give her when she starts collecting on her own. Quinn is much like Paul's repairman Jack, not bound by any rules that conventional law enforcement agents obey. Sure, he knows where the line is drawn. He just chooses to ignore it. So how did this collaboration start? Heather had an idea that involved Michael Quinn and a mausoleum containing a mysterious artifact. The problem? Repairman Jack works almost exclusively in New York City, so Paul had to come up with a way to bring him south to New Orleans. That's where Madame de Medici comes in. Who's that? You'll see.
Infernal Night. Jack wandered the room as they spoke. Okay, so Jules, the last surviving member of the Chastain family, was rich. If the private Gulfstream V that had flown him down here from LaGuardia and the Maybach with the liveried driver that had picked him up at the airport weren't enough, the sprawling New Orleans mansion provided sufficient backup. Moss-draped oaks had swayed in the breeze on either side of the house as the driver had let him out in front. "The Garden District," he'd said. Jack had no idea what that meant, but the neighborhood spoke of genteel wealth, of a time forgotten, of slow grace and a distant era. For all Jack knew, the manor house itself might have been a plantation once. With those massive pillars lining the front porch, it reminded him a little of Tara from Gone with the Wind. He'd done a little research before agreeing to come south. Jules Chastain had acquired his wealth the old-fashioned way, He'd inherited it. And the guy knew people, famous people. Newspaper clippings and original photos of Chastain with George W., with Obama, with Streisand, with Little Richard, now that was cool, lined the walls between artifacts from all over the world. Jack had lots of artifacts around his apartment, too, but mostly from the 1930s and 40s. These were from, like, pre-pyramid days. I could be impressed, he thought. He'd probably be definitely impressed if this guy was talking sense. He stopped his wandering to face Chastain, where he sat in some kind of Throne of Swords chair, only this wasn't a movie prop. With his thin mustache, thick glasses, and ridiculous silk smoking jacket, he looked like Percy Dove Tonsils on crack instead of martinis. Let me get this straight. You flew me all the way down here from New York to steal something you own from your family crypt?
Yes, Chastain said in a quavery voice. Exactly.
Okay. Now, since you're not crippled in any way I can see, go over again why you can't do this yourself.
As I explained, the artifact I seek was obtained from another collector who wants it back.
Because you stole it.
Mister, I never got your last name.
Jack had had dozens over the years. Just Jack'll do.
Very well, Jack. I assure you I can pay for anything I desire. Anything.
Not if the other guy doesn't want to sell. He glanced away.
Well, occasionally one runs into bullheaded stubbornness.
Which obliges one to steal. He waved a dismissive hand.
Oh, very well. Yes, I appropriated it without the owner's knowledge.
And the owner wants it back.
Yes. She discovered the appropriation.
He seemed incapable of saying theft. Oh, a she. You never mentioned that.
Madame de Medici, you've heard of her?
I hadn't heard of you until you called me, so why should I have heard of her?
Just wondering. You're familiar with the expression, hell hath no fury?
It's heaven has no rage, like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury, like a woman scorned. Chastain's eyebrows rose.
Oh, a poetry fan.
Not necessarily, just like to get things right. I had the misfortune of being an English major once.
Really? What school?
The name doesn't matter once you've dropped out. You were saying...
Well, if the true quote is, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned, then in this case we've got, nor hell a fury like a de Medici missing a piece from her collection. When I told her I didn't have her absent artifact, she went out and hired a hitman to kill me on sight.
Jack had to laugh. What is she, a mob wife?
Despite the name, she appears to be a Middle Easterner. The point is, she wants me dead.
Over the years, during the course of business, Jack had ended more than a few lives, but never on contract. Well, I hope you don't think I'm going to hit her, because that's not in my job description.
No, as I said, I just need someone to retrieve the artifact from the family mausoleum.
And you need a guy from New York for this? Why not somebody local?
I was told you are, what did he call you, an urban mercenary. Yes, an urban mercenary with a reputation for getting the job done and being a man of his word.
Where'd you hear all this?
I'm not sure the individual would like me talking about him. Let's just say you've had the benefit of an enthusiastic referral and leave it at that.
Jack wondered who it might be. He didn't know anyone in New Orleans. He shrugged it off. With the internet, the source could be anywhere. Still, there must be a local guy who can...
You also have a reputation for not being afraid of violence. That is, if attacked, you will counterattack rather than run.
Oh, don't go there. I've done my share of running. What else have you heard about me? Chastain frowned.
Very little. I made numerous queries. You don't seem to have an official existence. Some sources even said you don't exist at all. That repairman Jack is just some urban legend.
The frown morphed into a smile.
Interesting nickname, that.
Jack had never liked it himself, but things had progressed far past the point where he could do anything about it. Not my idea. Someone laid it on me and it stuck. As for the urban legend angle, that was fine with Jack. His favorite method was to play someone and leave them with no clue they'd been played. Those people never talked about Repairman Jack, just a terrible run of bad luck. But fixes didn't always go as planned, of course, and sometimes things got dicey. Sometimes people got violent. Sometimes people died. Those people never talked about Repairman Jack either. Chastain rose and stepped to a window that had to be a dozen feet high.
Well, whatever,
he said as he stared out at the night.
The thing is, with a hitman after me, I need someone who can overcome any resistance, retrieve the artifact in question, and bring it back. Too many locals would forget about that last part.
With a hitman after you, you shouldn't be standing at a window. Chastain stiffened, then ducked to the side.
I am so stupid at times, he said, drawing the curtains across the panes. I'm not geared for this kind of situation. That's why I need you.
Jack still wasn't buying. But the simple solution is to call this Medici lady and say it's in the mausoleum and tell her to go get it herself. Chastain's hands flew into the air.
I would, if I could. I've tried, but she's gone off the radar, incommunicado, and I fear the longer I wait, the shorter I'll live. If I can just get the artifact back in my hands, I can eventually negotiate a settlement. But I'm afraid to set foot outside the door.
Something not right here. Customers had tried to run games on him before. Was this another? How do I know you're not setting me up to steal this from her? Jules laughed.
It is in the Chastain Mausoleum. It's got my family name on it. I'll show you a back way in.
Why do I need a back way in if it's yours?
Take the front way if you wish. It's just that I fear Madame de Medici's hitman might suspect I'll show up there and be lying in wait.
Jack pulled his Glock from the small of his back. Traveling armed was a sweet perk of a private jet, and aimed it at Chastain's face. No need to lie in wait when you had him driven in from the airport. Chastain's eyes were fixed on the pistol as he backed away.
What? No!
Madame de Medici offered me twice your fee, Jack shrugged. You got played.
This is impossible!
quite possible. Jack returned the pistol to its nylon holster. But not true this time. Chastain sagged against the desk.
Why would you do such a thing?
Had my reasons. He had wanted to see Chastain's reaction, and it hadn't been what he had expected.
That was cruel,
he said, dropping back into his desk chair. No, just serving up a dose of reality. So, just what is this artifact? Jack pointed to a huge Olmec stone head in a corner. Not something like that, is it? Hysteria tinged Chastain's twittering laugh.
Oh, goodness, no! It's a ring. An ancient ring. I've drawn a diagram of the interior of the mausoleum so you can find the hiding place.
Jack didn't like this, any of it. But Chastain had called while Gia and Vicky were back in Iowa visiting her folks, and he felt the need for a brief change of scenery. A fat fee, round-trip transportation to New Orleans in a private jet, it had all sounded too good to be true. And naturally, that was how it was turning out. Hitman? Sheesh. He hadn't bargained for that. But if he could sneak in and sneak back out of this mausoleum with no one the wiser, everything would be cool. He'd stop by the French Quarter for a fried oyster poor boy and then be on his way. All right, let's get this over with. And money up front, all of it.
Certainly.
Chastain reached for an envelope on a nearby table in the shape of an elephant.
Cash in hundreds, as agreed.
Another one of those pursy dove tonsils smiles.
I take it Uncle Sam won't be seeing any of that.
Jack said nothing as he pocketed the envelope. He wouldn't know a 1040 if it poked him in the eye. Chastain said,
I was concerned you might not be armed, but no longer. I'll have my man drive you over to the plantation and...
You'll show me how to get there, then have your man drive me to where I can hail a cab. Arrive in a silver Maybach landaulet. Yeah, that would work.
Very well, but be prepared for deadly force.
Uh-huh. Got a map? After watching Chastain trace a path along the Mississippi to the location of the old Chastain plantation on River Road, Jack let himself out onto the front porch to wait for the car. He stood between two of the massive columns, staring out at the misty night and listening to his forebrain playing Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash, while his hindbrain blasted Go, now. Something definitely rotten in New Orleans. A guy with a contract out on him didn't stand at a window. He'd have all the curtains drawn and all the doors barricaded. So Jack had pulled his pistol to see how he'd react. In the context of having your name on a contract,
this is impossible,
was not a response that made any sense when looking down the muzzle of a gun. But it made plenty of sense if the contract didn't exist.